Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 126 of season 11 Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is a favored guest of mine, the godfather of the Movies by Minutes community, Jim O'Kane, who is still working on the Captain America Minute. And I'm loving listening to that 3 times a week. So, you know, welcome back to the show for another season, Jim.
Oh, somebody's got to stop me, Rob. I've got to get off this train. But it's, I always enjoy being on your show. And hopefully, I keep thinking this is going to be my last podcast talking about Captain America, but we'll see. But I do enjoy this, and thanks for having me on for this show. This is one of my favorite series. It's amazing. It came from the beginning of the era when TV shows became movies. I think this is the most cinematic, one of the most cinematic TV shows ever made. And yes. And it's all part of that Playtone idea. Playtone Productions really understood people have big screen TVs at home. They can enjoy, turn the lights out and enjoy a 6 to 12 hour movie right in their own home. And this is really, I think, became what, this kind of set the stage for a lot of other things along the way in the 21st century.
Right. But I'm assuming you believe and that you know that From the Earth to the Moon was the impetus for them to be able to do this. Because From the Earth to the Moon worked so well, they're like, hey, we can do this, which is a quote from the Earth to the Moon.
that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's again, Playtone was a pioneer or one of the pioneers of making this possible and shows that you could, you found cinematic that, you couldn't even show this in a movie theater because it's just so long and it went into such detail and the idea of chapters and things. I mean, this was coming at the same time as movies like The Lord of the Rings, where you were having trilogies being announced all at once. Well, this is a 10 part series that is one big movie. We get to know all the characters, and by here in episode 10, these people are like family to us as we're watching. We've watched them experience going through hell, and now here they're popping out on the other side and trying to deal with a new reality.
That's right, 100%. So, Jim, what is your background with Band of Brothers? Do you remember when you first saw it?
I remember seeing it on HBO, and I was watching this in Pennsylvania, and I can remember waiting every week for the next episode.
The next two episodes.
It was, the next two episodes, yeah. The back-to-back ones. And, it was just so astonishing because, I'm of a generation that had World War II veterans. Everybody in my neighborhood had a dad who was in World War II somewhere. They were in the Pacific. They were in the European theater. They might have been, they might have been working at Fort Dix in New Jersey, but they all played a part. And the commonality with them was none of them really talked about it that much.
Right.
Until they got older, much older. I remember my dad never talked really much about his experience other than he was a fireman in the Army Air Corps. And as he got older, he talked about different memories that he had. He wasn't in infantry. He was very fortunate to be kicked out of the infantry. He was part of the 101st. And he came home. They were just after basic training. He was still in New Jersey, and he got he was a sergeant, and he got demoted one rank to corporal because he got back 10 minutes late from a weekend leave to go home and visit his folks. And the lieutenant that was running his company said that you don't deserve to be in airborne, and we're going to move you over to a different division of the Air Corps, and you can go, put out fires and things. And what saved him was every guy that he was with in basic wound up being captured during the Battle of Bastogne. So he missed all of that, and it may have saved his life.
Wow.
But it was like he saw a lot of hard things. Recently, one of my cousins found a scrapbook that my grandmother had left, and I had not known about this. My dad had talked about there were a bunch of souvenirs and pictures and things that he had lost, and he didn't know whatever happened to them. And apparently, one of my aunts had them. My cousin, after my aunt had passed, had been going through the scrapbook, and she was, I'm really blessed to have received some of my cousin forwarded me some of my dad's typed letters as he went across England and France during, like 1943, 1944. And just reading, I actually have a note from the chaplain of my dad's company writing to my dad's parish priest back in New Jersey about how my grandfather was dying. He had this, I'm sorry, this is going to get into a very complicated thing, but I
I'm
picture
hanging
this.
on to every word.
Okay, my dad, my dad was he entered school late, so he turned 18 while he was still a junior in high school, and he was drafted right out of high school and was sent overseas. At the time, his father, my grandfather, was working for the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, and he was my grandfather had been working in oil fields in Venezuela and Costa Rica, and at the time during the late 1930s, there was an outbreak of equine encephalitis, and it was there was no treatment for it. Nobody knew what it was, for one thing. There was this mysterious disease that was attacking oil workers, and my grandfather came home and started having stroke-like symptoms, and he was having problems with motor control and paralysis. And so when my father was sent overseas, my grandfather was dying, and my dad was the only one of age in the family. I mean, my grandmother was working at the Singer sewing machine factory making bombs for the war effort, and so was my two of my aunts were old enough and were working in factories, but there was no male adult, and so my dad was asking for a hardship exemption to go home because he was the only male person that could take care of things. While my grandfather was dying during the D-Day invasion, the army told my dad, "Sorry, we need you here, and you can't go home." And my dad was very upset because he couldn't get home to take care of his family. Now he was the man of the house because my grandfather had died. And I was just reading this letter between this chaplain in England and my dad's parish priest back in New Jersey, and it's just he said, "I'm sorry, I wish there was something we could do, but there's a lot of things afoot now, and we need all of our troops here. And maybe in the future he could come home, but not right now." And as it turned out, he never got home until September of 1945. So he was away while all this drama was going on at home. And my dad never really talked much about it, except that he felt that the army had kind of ignored his needs and his family's needs. So it wasn't quite it was not resentment. It was just this, and he understood that all the stakes that were going on at the time, but he felt very frustrated that he couldn't help his family while he was thousands of miles away at a war that he got drafted into.
Right. Oh, wow. Wait,
And
now
when you, yeah,
I
go ahead.
remember that during Saving Private Ryan, you told me a cookie story. Was that cookie story about your father or about an uncle?
I'm trying to remember which cookie story
There was a story that
he.
someone asked to send them cookies, and they sent a package of
Oh.
cookies overseas.
Yes. That's later on. That was a Christmas one. He had apparently cookies were like it was like currency over there. That if you had baked goods coming, and he told he it was this very involved letter that was written the day after Christmas, and my dad was very upset. A lot of the letter concerned that on Christmas Day the army had arranged to have fresh eggs instead of powdered eggs. And he had overslept and missed the eggs,
Right.
and so he had a powdered eggs. And my dad had For the rest of his life, he had a marked aversion to powdered eggs or instant anything.
Right. Okay.
So,
Okay. I recall that we talked about that.
yeah, and yeah, and the cookies were, you know, please. He kept asking for more cookies, but because apparently everybody liked them, everybody in the company liked them, and he was taking a. At the time, I was wondering why he had written all these typed letters, but he was actually trying to teach himself how to use a typewriter. So he had a. There was apparently an Army secretarial course manual that he was like flipping over and typing, you know, ASDF semicolon LKJ and learning how to type on a typewriter, because while he was a fireman on an air base, in between the flights going out and the flights coming back, he really had nothing to do. I mean, you could clean the fire truck one more time, but what he did was he just sat down and taught himself how to type. And
So
so
he was channeling his inner Tom Hanks. That's what you're saying.
yes. Yeah. So somehow he, unfortunately he didn't collect Underwoods and things like that to send home. But, he, you know, and in these stories that I would read about in his letters, the few letters that we got that we have preserved, I felt like in watching Band of Brothers, all these guys had a different story to tell. And some of them never got to tell their stories, but, you know, fortunately we know at least some of the stories coming out of Easy Company. And there, and some of the, you know, and like it was, a lot of them were problematic stories. You don't know if who the good, you know, if there were some good guys or bad guys in your platoon or in your company, that, you know, what did they do? Like, you know, not, this isn't my episode, but you know, episodes before where we found out they were possibly shooting German prisoners, and nobody was ever sure of that. And there's some things coming up, not in the minutes that we're going to be talking about, but
And
there's, you know,
looting,
some,
looting, lots of
yeah,
looting.
and looting, that it was, that was okay apparently. It's like, oh, you know, it's Goering, we can take this, or we can break into whatever we want, and there's nobody to, you know, take it on. So it's there, and actively being told by your superior officers, yeah, go take what you want, you're, you know, bring up a truck and grab whatever you want out of this house or that house. So and you know, that's in this current scene that we're looking at. We go to Goering's house, and
Well, we're not
you
there
know, there's a
yet.
little
We're
kind
not there yet.
of,
We're
oh
starting.
no, well no, this, no, we're still looking at that at that less than perfect model of Birch's Garden
Yes.
up on the hill. I think, you know, the Thunderbirds had more realistic model work on that one on the hill, I felt.
If you listen to the interview that I did with the set designer, he basically said that towards the end they were running out of money. You know, so
Okay, that, yeah,
it
that makes
makes
sense.
sense.
Which is why, you know, you always do things tails out. That's what I learned in film school. Work from the back to the front, and you put all your money in the back,
That's right. Well,
because people will get as you build up. But you know,
that's
well,
right.
they're doing this thing.
Well, that's why you
It,
always started recording, you know, at like episode 7, you know, instead of.
yeah, people will forgive you if you're, you know, up and down. So, but it's, yeah, it's just intriguing seeing seeing this thing, and I don't know what Birch's Garden looks like nowadays, but I hope they have better resolution up there.
Okay.
I did, yeah, I did look up. I didn't know you can stay up there. Well, I mean, of course, there's people that are tourists, but there's some pretty fancy hotels that are built up there nowadays, and it's only $400 a night. So,
Okay, that's a chump change. You know, there you go.
yeah.
Especially
It's, I
for
mean.
podcasters like us who rake in the millions, you know,
Oh yeah,
with our movies
well,
by
well maybe
the
they'll,
podcast.
yeah, just you have to pay for it in exposure.
There,
So
that's right. That's right. So episode 126 begins with Winters continuing to describe the Eagle's Nest and ends with the men being mesmerized by the sights and views around them. We end things on Friday with Winters, you know, beginning to give his narration of everything that's going on. I mean, I really like the way that this part, that part 10 is given, you know, that they gave this one to Winters to be the narrator.
yeah.
You know, it fits so well because this is a character who is not only the leader, but he's the father figure for all of them. And
Yeah.
the way that he narrates this entire part, you can hear the fatherly tones in a lot of the things that he's saying and doing. We'll get to it a little bit later in the week and next week also, when he talks about some of the tragedies that happen. And you know, we can also see that that his orders are always, do whatever you can that nobody gets hurt. We're at a point where we need to save as many of these men as possible. So that really works well. So basically, Winters begins this episode with him basically describing the Eagle's Nest itself. And, he was talking about the fact that it was only accessible, and he continues today by saying, by a gold-plated elevator. It was one of the crown jewels of his empire. And then he has to throw in that little tidbit, and the man was afraid of heights. Now, I looked it up. Hitler apparently really was acrophobic. He really did not like to do that. But which is one of the reasons why he apparently didn't go visit that often. The Eagle.
Well, I heard that was also one of the problems that he had in flying. He did not like to he didn't like he preferred getting around it by car rather than by aircraft. I mean, if you showed him a Junkers, it was like, ah, no, maybe we can just drive there.
And I mean, apparently, I also read that he visited the Eagle's Nest less than 15 times, through the time that he was around, and he also was extremely afraid every time he went into that elevator, because the elevator apparently went up through the center of the mountain. And he always was afraid that the winch would either give way or that it would attract lightning strikes and things like that.
Ooh, or get stuck. I can't imagine having to climb your way out of it.
I can't imagine Hitler having to try and climb his way out of it.
Yeah. Wow. But I guess he, yeah. And it was given to him as a birthday present. Is that
Yes,
correct?
it was for
That,
his 50th birthday.
well,
So, and
if he had to say, well, thanks,
he
or.
died at the age of 56, which means that it was built in 1939, 5 months before, or four months before he started, before he attacked Poland.
For on
Because Poland, he started on September 1st, 39.
October.
No, Poland was September 1st, 39.
September 1st, that's right,
Right.
yeah.
And so his birthday was April 20th, and in 1939 was when he turned 50 years old. So that's it's pretty interesting that this was built for him even before he decided his full conquest, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well, he had 6 years of figuring out ways of saying no. Only he only had to come up with that, and let's not go there this year for 6 years.
Exactly.
Wow.
I'm expecting a call from Goering. I can't leave.
Yeah. I got this thing coming up. Yeah, sorry.
I'm recording a podcast. I can't.
Yeah.
So yeah,
Not that week. Yeah, they're
it's great the way that
just.
first of all, I love the camera shot also. That I
Yeah,
again, I agree with
the
you.
POV
I
is
agree
really
with you that
great.
the model isn't that great, but it's still, the as you said, the POV gives us the feel that we're in a Jeep or a truck on our way there looking up, which obviously is
Yeah,
what we do.
it's an admirable simulation. It just feels like, and we're looking at this with 2026 eyes, so we're used to a little bit better like CGI and stuff like that. This is probably an actual physical model. And I think nowadays they'd be doing it in an Unreal Engine or one of, some kind of a. They probably have AI do it and just crank out an image, and there'd be very dramatic clouds and stuff. But it works. And even there's the scenes. I think two scenes ahead of this, where they're on like that balcony or
Yeah,
porch
we'll get there. We'll
overlooking.
talk about those matte paintings,
Yeah.
which is what they look like.
Yeah.
But so,
Yeah, but I mean, it's still acceptable. It's
yeah,
acceptable for
well, it's
TV.
also
I mean, sitting
acceptable
and
for 2001.
watching TV is fine.
I think you have to look at it more
Yeah.
from that perspective, as opposed to acceptable for TV, because nowadays, the CGI and AI in TV in some ways is up to par with what they do in movies. Depending on what show, obviously, and depends
Yeah.
on their
Yeah.
budget. And then the shot changes, and we hear a door opening, and we see Spears. Well, we have Malarkey, Moore, and Grant. They walk in, and you see that they walk into this beautiful penthouse area, very lavish. These guys are all in complete shock of what they're looking at, you know. And Spears sends Malarkey to go check one of the rooms to make sure nobody's there and that it's all clear. And, you know, Spears, as we know, likes to loot. So I'm sure his mind is going through, what's going through his mind right now is, okay, how can I carry this? And, you know, how much of this can I take with me?
Yeah, we're, you know, can I get this through the army version of UPS? And
That's right.
how am I going to
And then
box this
we
without it
see
breaking?
more start to, you know, drink from a champagne bottle, and then Spear sees a someone on the ground, so he runs over to them, and you see a German, I guess, officer, on the ground with a there's a pistol next to him, and there's a little a blood stain on the carpet that you know will probably make Spears decide that he's not going to be taking that carpet with him, because getting that blood stain out is pretty difficult. You know, it's like there's I don't remember who the comedian is. There's some comedian that always had a bit about the fact that, you know, when you see commercials for laundry detergent and they show you like all the things that they're like, why are they constantly why do people's clothes constantly have blood in them that you need to get rid of?
Yeah. Yes,
Exactly.
yeah, Child Protective
100%.
Services should be called.
100%. Now,
Something's
I
going
know
on.
something very interesting about this dead soldier. When Spears rolls him over, you can see on his arm, there's something that says Adolf Hitler on it, or at least that's what it looks like. It's not Hitler.
Yeah, that's in I think. No, but I think that's for the I think that's for SS. If I'm not mistaken, that's like you're really high up in the party in the SS. I may
That
be
you have like a signature on your
Yeah, it's a script it's a script that says that says Adolf Hitler on it. You're in the Adolf Hitler I've forgotten the name and I probably should have looked it up, but there's it's like you were an early it's not as there's two different things. There's one that you can wear a pin that says that you were the first 100,000 members of the Nazi Party that people wore on their lapels, but the Adolf Hitler Brigade, I think is what it was, is that you were an early you were part of the early group of SS people. I may be wrong about this, but I think that's what that signified.
Okay, well, I just did a quick search for it, and it's anyone who was in the first SS Panzer Division, which was known as the Adolf Hitler Division, they were his
Yeah.
personal bodyguards.
Yeah, you're like way up in the org.
So yeah, they had embroidered text either in silver or white thread using traditional German Sutherland stylized Gothic script.
Oh.
Right, so it was only it says here that there are a lot of movies that get it wrong, but it's because they give it to all of the SS, and it should only be for
The personal guard, basically the centurions, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. I never even thought about that before. It's interesting that you know that these guards were walking around with their boss's name on their sleeve.
Yeah, and it doesn't look like he doesn't look like he's been dead that long. So, I mean, was he watching the Jeeps driving up the hill and thought, well, I had my chance to get out of here, but
That's right. Well, Hitler did it, so I might as well kill myself too.
yeah, follow the leader.
Oh, actually, Hitler. Once again, I'm trying to remember if
Well,
Hitler's dead here. Yeah, I can't even remember if Hitler died yesterday
yeah,
or
he died yesterday
on
because
Friday. Right. Okay.
yeah. So yeah, so I mean I guess I don't know how fast the news was reaching up in the mountains, but I would
Well.
imagine that
When you see Easy Company showing up, you don't want to have to fight them. So.
yeah. Just leave the silverware behind and hit the road.
That's
Just
right. And Spears then basically pockets the gun. And the great
yeah.
thing is as he's tending to the body, we hear a popping sound, which sounds like a gunshot. You know,
Yeah,
and
like
it's actually Malarkey opening up a another champagne bottle. And Malarkey then
yeah.
walks over and goes, "Here's to him." Hosting the dead German, the dead
Yeah.
Panzer.
And I gotta say, Scott Grimes through this entire series has been the, for lack of a better term, I think he's been the organizing sensibility of what it's like being one of the troops. I mean, we're supposed to, I think we're supposed to follow along with Nixon, and you know, just being a part of when, you know, Winters, we are in the club with Winters and Nixon. But really understanding what the troops are going through, the grunts that are on, you know, on the ground guys, Scott Grimes as Malarkey, he's the guy that I think we identify with. He's reacting to stuff. And at this point, you know, they've conquered the eagle's nest, and here's maybe this is his last dead German that he's got to deal with.
Right, that's true. Yeah, then he drinks up, and then we see someone open up a photo album, which I guess you can call this. So here you have Chekhov's photo album, you know, which is very
And
funny that they give us this.
yeah, so we'll put a pin in this one,
Okay.
and it'll be coming up later. But it's just amazing. And if you read the books, the you know what happens with this photo album is gonna it's fascinating how it kind of goes into history and then comes back out in history. So yeah, just let's leave that for a
Right,
later
but we
discussion.
see that Moore is looking at the pictures, and you know, this is a place that Hitler didn't visit. Why would he have his photo out there?
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, it's also a place relative, I mean, down the hill, the British bombed Goering's house, but it's relatively untouched. There's really, the war never
Right.
got here. The war never got this close to anything else. And this was always, you know, this was supposed to be a retreat. You know, it's the place where you just hang out and see things. There was dining rooms, and it's just, and that's, I mean, and this is something that we're going to be seeing through this in the next couple of minutes of the show. After all this warfare and stuff, the idea of, you know, these guys have been walking through bombed out chateaus, and they've marched across the Netherlands, and just dealing with so much destruction. And then here you come up at the seat of Nazi grandeur, you know, all the thefts and so, you know, the deprivations of everybody below this hillside. All these guys walking in on it, they're all, you know, none of them shaved, they probably haven't had a bath in a couple of days, and now they're up in this opulence. And it's you really get a sense of the shock of, wow, this is a resort in the middle of war.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. It's
Yeah.
great
Oh
to
yeah.
see.
And you can see why they wanted, I mean, we'll talk about it later, but you can see why they wanted to stay here for a bit. It's like, let's just take a break. It's been a long
That's
war.
right. And then the shot changes, and now we see a Nixon with Welsh outside, and they start having a conversation, and they're laughing it up, and then Nixon goes, "No, God damn it! Listen, Hitler, Hitler, no, Hitler, Himmler, Goering," and then Welsh goes, "And Goebbels, Goebbels." So I think they're trying to show these guys have had a little bit to drink. They're slightly inebriated at this point.
Yeah, and then trying to go over the Third Reich org chart.
More or less, exactly. And then Winters and Lipton show up, and they start laughing also, listening to this whole conversation. And I think this goes back to what we were talking about before. The view from this balcony is breathtaking, but it's easy to tell that it's a matte painting.
Yeah,
They're
I mean
nailing it.
it's a beautiful it looks like it's a big cyclorama that's built behind the stage. You know, it's probably back about maybe 50, 60 feet, so they can get a little bit of parallax as they're moving the camera around. Yeah, it's very well done. You know, again, you can't fault them for doing this on a budget. And
Right.
you get the whole idea, they're out sunning themselves on, you know, on deck chairs
That's
on,
right.
you know, Hitler's patio.
Right. And so, Spears is the third one that's there. And then when Welsh sees that Winter shows up, he goes, Hey, Adolf, love your eagle's nest. And he says, I hope you don't mind. We made ourselves at home. Love what you've done with the place here. He goes, hey, have a drink. Come on. Just so we can say we saw you do it. Because, that it's a running joke throughout the whole series. The fact that Winters, nobody really knows if Winters is a Mennonite or not. And, does he drink? Does he not drink? And they sort of keep us on the edge with this. They don't actually go out and tell us what he is from.
Well, I was wondering if we're taking it the wrong way on that. If he was actually still pretending, he said, "Hey, Hitler, love your place." If that he's saying, just to say we've seen you take a drink, because Hitler was a well-known teetotaler. So, it's like the only thing that Winters and Hitler have in common is they don't drink. Although we did see him
Maybe
on another
he
occasion.
was also a Mennonite.
Yeah, you never know. So,
Anything's possible.
yeah,
And
and
then, right. And then Winters at this point gives him an update and he goes, listen up, from Corps, just came in. Effective immediately, all troops stand fast on present positions. And Nixon, lifts up his bottle and goes, standing fast. And the funny thing is, it's Spears that is the one that doesn't understand this order, because Spears is a guy who wants to constantly keep moving. Maybe because he wants to loot more and more, or because that's just who he is. He wants to, conquer as much as possible along the way. He goes, "What does that mean?" And they all start laughing. It's great that we get to see these officers, acting differently than they would act in front of the men, basically.
Yeah, just they're at extremely
That's right,
at
and
ease.
it shows a human side to all of them at this point, which is nice. And then Winters then says, "So, do you want to hear it?" And Welsh goes, "Uh-uh." He goes, "Are you ready for it? Listen up. The German army surrendered," and everyone's in complete shock. And then Winters turns to Nixon and goes, "But I've got a present for you. Come on."
But
That's
wait,
right.
there's more. Yeah.
Let's see what's
So,
behind door number two.
yeah.
And Nixon then grabs his utility belt and goes to him while Lipton and Welsh give a hug. And it seems as if it's because Welsh is just really drunk and wants to give someone a hug.
Yeah.
And they just they linger on them for a few more seconds before they move on. And then we see Winters and Nixon in a Jeep, and Nixon still has a bottle of champagne with him. Good thing he's not driving. It's good to have Winters as the designated Mennonite driver. And then they come in, they come out of a clearing, and you see a house that is half shelled.
Yeah, the British got to it, I think, the week before, or maybe 2 weeks before. They had started bombing up in the area there. Didn't get up to the Eagle's Nest, but they did get the lower third of Burch's Garden and managed to bang on Goering's
And
house.
Nixon then goes, "What is this place?" Now, it's very funny that Nixon is asking that question since he is the intelligence officer. He's the one who should know this answer. And Winters goes, he goes, "Hermann Goering's house. We
Oh, yeah.
discovered it yesterday. Had it on double guard ever since." And they get out of the Jeep, and O'Keefe is standing at the door, and he goes, "I can vouch for that, sir." He goes, "Oh, anxious to get off duty, O'Keefe." He goes, "No, there's just so much to see and do, sir. Even someone like O'Keefe, who we saw, just last week, excited about the fact that they're going to go kill Germans, now he just wants to see the sight. He's seen the lights. He realizes that you don't have to go out and fight. You can enjoy being an occupier of Austria, instead." And they have a great shot of Winter's hand, where he puts out his hand, and O'Keefe gives him the key.
Yeah, the Ober Salzburg is the name of that area where the Goering's house was. I'm sorry. It was 2 weeks before late April 45. British bombers heavily damaged part of the villa during the air raid. And well, anyway, we're getting ahead. But
Okay, and
keep
then
let's go down the
Winters
stairway.
takes the key, opens the door, comes inside, turns on the light, and Nixon follows him, still with his sunglasses on. Is it because it's too bright for him because he's also experiencing hangover, or just laziness?
Yeah, it's just,
And
well,
then
he's got to do the Jurassic Park thing.
yes, that's too awesome. True. And they walk down the stairs into a cellar that first of all, Nixon takes off his glasses, like you said, and he's completely in shock of what's going on. And then we get a him just looking around at this room that is filled with a whole bunch of lots and lots and lots of bottles.
Yeah, it was back to the far distance. It looked like a cathedral of a wine cellar. Just amazing how much, and according to this, 10,000 bottles
And
available
Winter
there.
says in his narration, he goes, 10,000 bottles of the world's finest liquor, wine and champagne. Health Easy marked the day the war in Europe came to an end. And then we hear Winters actually say to Nixon, he goes, it's all yours. Take what you want and have
Yeah.
each company take a truckload. We're heading for Austria in the morning. Don't feel you have to leave anything for whoever comes next. But you see, the
Yeah,
irony
and
is that they're taking all of these bottles, but where are they going to keep them? They're moving forward. It's not like you can put them in
yeah.
your knapsack and how many bottles can you are you going to have room for to take with you as you continue into Austria?
And if it's champagne, it's not going to travel very well if you're bouncing along on the back of a jeep.
Yeah, you got to be careful when you
You'll be hearing a
open.
lot of more corks
That's
popping.
right.
Yeah. But and the other thing about Goering's chateau there is that not only did they find the wine, that was just one part of it, finding the liquor, but there were vast quantities of stolen art, luxury goods, and one of the besides the wine collections, there's statues, there's all kinds of things that got shipped up the mountain from Goering was out collecting things from across Europe. So a lot of this stuff, even though the soldiers were taking the bottles and whatever could fit in their pockets, a lot of that artwork was going to have to get returned to the various countries that it had been looted
Right.
from. So it caused a big, I mean, there was a logistics problem at the end of the war, trying to figure out who owned what where, and that went on for decades of trying to resolve all that stuff.
That's right. Again, it's amazing the things that the Germans collected, let's say, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah.
And but the bottom line is Winters knows that Nixon is going to be happy about the booze.
Oh yeah.
It might not be that
Get them.
69, but
That 69, yeah. Yeah, he'll make do.
that's right.
And yeah, as I said earlier, this where we're looking at that wine cellar, it's the Intercontinental Resort Berchtesgaden, and there's a small pond at the hotel, roughly marks the former location of the house. And there are still some remnants of stairs, foundation, and the swimming pool area, including the wine cellar, are still visible nearby. So if you can, if you've got $400 a night and you feel like tripping toward the Austrian border, you can go visit Berchtesgaden to this day and see mountains that don't look like a matte painting.
O'Keefe is there, and he goes, "Austria, sir?" And Winter goes, "Happy VE Day." And Nixon goes, "Yeah." And he starts laughing. And then O'Keefe goes, "VE Day?" And Nixon goes, "Victory in Europe." So what's really interesting is that it's very strange that today is the day that the Germans surrendered, and they already know that the term is VE Day.
Well, that actually came back. VE had been coined back in September. Did you want to talk about James Byrne, or
Yeah,
I
go
can?
ahead. Go ahead.
James Byrne was the fellow that coined the term VE Day. Now, James Byrne is one of the most, I'd only heard mention of him as a Supreme Court justice, but he had a very interesting life during World War II. He actually served in all three branches of government. He was he was in the House of Representatives. He was a senator. Then he was elected to the Supreme. He was or nominated and voted in by the Senate to the Supreme Court. And in 1943, FDR asked him to resign from the Supreme Court and run the Office of Economic Stabilization. That was ones where they're trying to figure out how to get civilian companies like Ford and General Motors and Boeing, all these other ones, to stop making commercial products and start making military products. So he was in charge of that.
Wasn't it called the Office of War Mobilization? Or that's later on?
That's later on. Originally, it was called Economic Stabilization, and then there was more war mobilization became part of it, where he basically had a he they called him the junior president or the second president because he had this executive authority that I don't know how legal it was or constitutional it was. It didn't seem to Congress didn't say no. So this guy was in charge of reassigning industries what they should be doing for the war effort. And he came up with the term VE Day. He coined it in September of 1944. He worked he resigned just before the death of FDR. So he was no longer in that job. He resigned that Office of War Mobilization and Economic Stabilization, and became Secretary of State for Truman. So he worked in the legislative, judicial, and the highest levels of the executive office. Then, after he was done with Truman as Secretary of State, he later became governor of South Carolina. So he just quite a long. He really knew how to get those government jobs.
Yeah,
But he came up with the
you
idea
missed
of.
one little thing there along the way. He was
Oh.
he almost became FDR's running mate when they got when they dumped Wallace in 44.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Can
And
you imagine where he would have gone had he actually gotten that?
yeah. So quite a career. But yeah, he came up with and VE Day was kind of an abstract idea. It's like, well, we've got to work toward this, and then what we're going to do after that is we're this is going to have they're going to have to demobilize. But he wasn't into the demobilization because he was already Secretary of State by then. So he just put that as, you know, on all their little org or PERT charts or whatever they did for project management back in the 40s. He said, and then when VE Day hits, then 20 days after VE Day, we're going to have to start doing this, and then 90 days this. So VE, at least in government bureaucrat circles, VE was a common phrase, which makes sense why an intelligence officer like Nixon would have heard of it, because all he was getting back from
Right.
Washington was, we're shooting for VE Day, and this is what we're going to do. So there were plans in place. He was, you know, the other thing, Byrne was also with, he was with FDR at Yalta. So, you know, he was like
Right.
kind of a super Henry Kissinger. He was involved in everything in turning the knobs and dials, but he gets almost no screen time in any World War II movie I've ever seen, which is
So
amazing.
you see, now you have an idea to make a movie. Make
There
a movie about Burns.
you go. Make a James Byrne movie.
Right. And I mean, he also has the distinction of being the shortest serving Supreme Court justice
Oh, okay.
because he served only 1 year and 87 days
Wow. I wonder
before
if he could,
retirement.
yeah, if he could get his money back on the robe. It's wow. Fascinating life.
Yes, and he lived to the age of 90 also.
Yeah.
So that's he did he had a lot to do during those 90 years.
Definitely, yeah.
So and you know then we get a shot of a lot of the bottles in the room, and you can see how dusty everything is from like I guess from the bombing.
Yeah.
You think that more bottles would have exploded, but
Good, you know, good solid German construction. I guess they really knew their foundations. And the idea that nobody, I keep thinking about the people, you know. Well, they probably said on your Friday episode that you couldn't deny you were a Nazi if you lived in Berchtesgaden, because these were all the true believers. These are the hardcore guys. So all these people were still living with the idea that, well, we got to keep everything nice because, when the Fuhrer comes back, it'll still be as we kept it, and we won't be yelled at. It's kind of like the guys on the White Star Line that were worried about the destruction of property in the
That's
Titanic as it was going down. So there's people that just, weren't capturing that the idea that they, it's time, it's time to go. They didn't see the exit signs flashing. But
right.
yeah.
Yeah, very, very interesting the way that they show that from that perspective. Nixon's having a blast. That doesn't come down to. Yeah. I mean, I've never been in a wine cellar this size. You probably know these things. Is do you keep the bottles in a certain order? Do you like chronological? Do you put them in chronological order or something like that?
I don't know how they like how they I used to work in a restaurant, and what we used to use, it's kind of like if you went to a 7-Eleven or some kind of convenience store, if you're trying to, what you do is you rotate the old stuff out front. But although with wines, often the older stuff you want to,
That's right.
keep the most level. Although they do have a shelf life, I know that after a while, you can't, like, you have to drink it at a certain in a certain range, otherwise it's gonna get bitter, especially like the champagnes and stuff like that.
Okay.
But then you can, mix it up with some oil and pour it over your salad or something. It's just,
Apparently.
yeah.
Apparently. And then the shot changes and we see trucks driving through the Austrian countryside.
Yeah.
And as you know, it's great also you see the German soldiers walking in the other direction as they're moving past them. We hear the narration from Winters. Instead of an aggressive combat unit, we became an occupation force. And no
And
one wanted to leave Berchtesgaden until they saw Austria. Which is great.
yeah, no, it's beautiful. And this is one of my favorite parts of the whole series, because we get to hear Michael Kamen's what's un, with a remarkable lack of inspiration. It's known as Suite 2 from Band of Brothers. I mean, we all know that waltz that introduces every show. There's that's Suite 1. But now we get to hear Suite 2, which is such a it's a pastoral sound. It's a very it complements that the main theme, that Suite 1, is more like a hymn, and this one's a choral. It's very much Michael Kamen, and we heard this in Kamen, the previous Kamen show with From the Earth to the Moon. He leaned more into it. It's a lot more cinematic, but it is a concert hall worthy song. There's a lot of contrasts in it.
It's
There's
also very
the
uplifting to listen to it.
yeah.
I love the music. I mean, I think Michael Kamen was among one of the best movie orchestra movie composers
Yeah,
of all time. I mean, I love John Williams stuff, but Michael Kamen does something very different. The way
and
that he
he has a style that's different from Williams, it's different from Horner, but it's so
I think it's just because it's so emotional.
it
I think
is
it
it is it's extremely emotional. You feel the camaraderie, you feel the loss, you feel resilience, you feel the dignity of the soldiers. There's so many themes that run through this that you'll hear that come up with different characters, and it builds that rhythmic sound, the triplets, and all those the harp arpeggios that are going on. There's the violoncello combinations, the strings that are driving this whole thing, and you're hearing underneath it the baritones, the trombones, and I think there's French, definitely French horn, and it just slowly keeps building this really layered orchestration. There's brass and string swells. It has and it's uplifting, but it's also melancholy, and it has I think the best way to describe it is it shows the hard-won triumph that you're feeling. Kamen has a very humanistic style in this. You're feeling the people that are involved, and that all the stuff they've been through, especially, they're on this truck, they're going into beautiful Austria. There's these beautiful blonde women waving at them and smiling, and it's like they're coming out of a nightmare. They're all exhausted, and this is almost like an ascension into a heavenly afterlife. It's so it this the music sounds like it's something like Elgar would write. It's a very, very pastoral sound. You're not hearing any dissonance. There's no it's very smooth. So it had the closest thing I could think of that comes near to what Kamen did was the John Williams score for Saving Private Ryan, which has a similar
Right. Came into the
motif.
fall.
Yeah, but I think you're feeling it's not triumphant, but it's victorious, and it's not there's still a sense of melancholy in it, but and it goes on. I mean, this music plows through the rest of of these clips that you hear it going through, and you feel kind of a sense of relief, relaxation. You're at ease.
Right. I think it's like a 10-minute suite. I'm pretty sure because I have it, so I listen to it all the time. Also, I love the music, and it's perfectly accentuated here by the at the end with at the end of our the segment that we're the 5-minute segment where Talbert then goes, so do you reckon they'll make us run up those or ski down them? By just seeing the vast mountains that are in front of them, and again, these guys just don't know how to. How to internalize the fact that just a few months ago they were going through the hell of Bastogne, and now they're looking at these beautiful this beautiful scenery and view all around them.
Yeah, it's like that first spring day. It's just it's hard to readjust to saying you're not at war anymore. This is okay. You can just relax now. There's nobody's out trying to kill you right now.
That's right.
So, and just the and it's gonna get and the music is very thought inducing. If you feel like this is what you'd sit and think about what you just experienced, and you're just trying to process stuff. So these really big, broad swells, you're like, yeah, I remember that, remember that, remember that. And I think the lyrical nature of it doesn't, as far as I know, nobody's ever written lyrics to this, the second suite. So
No,
it,
not
but
that
it
I.
really comes close to, you could feel like there's some kind of, well, I think the narration goes over what you would put in lyrics for this part of the movie or this part of the series.
Right. But again, I don't think you need lyrics here.
No.
It does what it needs to do wordlessly.
Right.
Which is perfect. All right, and that's how this 5-minute segment ends. Is there anything else you wanted to add about this segment?
No, I think we got it pretty well, and it's an interesting way to end a war
Yes, that is true.
in Hitler's living room, yeah.
That's
So.
very true. All right, so today's segment is called Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five movie bands. So, Jim, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Ooh, okay, this is not in any order, so I'm gonna have to figure my order. Okay, with number five, I'm gonna go. It was not a band, but a singer. So I'm gonna go with Johnny Fontaine from The Godfather. And I always like Johnny Fontaine's story. He's an interesting guy that kind of wends his way in and out of the movie. And the idea that somehow Johnny Fontaine singing at a wedding would result in a dead horse head in a movie producer's
That's right.
bed. So, number four, I would say, would be the Pinheads from Back to the Future. That was Marty McFly's band that was playing at the. They were trying for whatever the 1985 version of the Enchantment Under the Sea dance.
Yeah,
So,
I'm sorry. You're just too darn loud.
yeah, that's right. And when Huey Lewis tells you that,
You
you know
know.
you're just too darn loud.
That's right.
So yeah, I'd go with him as number four. Number three, the Cruisers of Eddie and the Cruisers. They were way ahead of their time. They just didn't know that they were way ahead of the time. Eddie knew, but they would just play whatever Eddie gave them. It's an interesting movie. It doesn't get enough notice, I think, nowadays. I mean, that was
Right.
45 years ago.
I think the music in the movie, I've talked about this in the past with other guests that have used this, that have brought this up, but I think that it's a better band than a movie, meaning the songs are great.
Yeah, I always felt sorry for John Cafferty, who actually, that was, the Beaver Brown band was actually the Cruisers. And I saw the Beaver Brown, I saw them say that three times fast. I saw the Beaver Brown band play back in the early 80s, just after the movie came out. And I met the sax player there who since passed. But they're a really talented group of musicians, and it's a shame they were kind of subsumed by the movie. I mean, it's like, oh, they're really good. They're, living in the CITY. Let's see. That's one, two, three,
That
four.
was
Okay.
three.
Three.
And
And
number two.
number four, something we've talked about
Number two,
offline.
number two, number
Oh,
two.
number two, number two, number two. Yes. That number two, we've talked about this particular band offline, but my number two band is the River City Boys Band. So from The Music Man, you have to use the think system. And I've viewed I, there this is in my family, The Music Man has so many phrases in it that my family uses in normal conversation as shorthand for different things. I have to say that we start talking about using the think system on multiple things. So the River City Boys Band, definitely, if you can put together a band by thinking about it, I mean, that's how you work kazoo or that's how you whistle. Anybody can have their own band. So they're my number two. But number one, and I'm sure everybody said this band before on your thing. I don't know how many of them picked number one. Yet another Playtone movie. I have to pick The Wonders or The Oneaters, as my wife has a T-shirt with the Oneaters poster on it. That
Why does that not surprise me?
it's a great film. It's it's so it's so such a part of our, again, it's something that you can rewatch so many times. And if he's a genius, I'm Utan. It's something else that we say in my house an awful lot. But I can recommend, if you haven't seen the movie That Thing You Do, I can strongly recommend. You can easily recommend this to anybody you know, and you will not offend anybody. And it's a great romance. It's a great comedy, and it's a great look at the '60s and how things worked back then. And it even has Mo Green from. From The Godfather, so I can come full circle with that.
That's true. That's true.
So those are my five.
And
I
I
go with
mean,
those five.
it's also they have the other side of the single that Jim got to dance to.
That's right. That was we played All My Only Dreams at my wedding, and it has a lot of meaning to my family. So I can feel emotionally involved with the Tom Hanks movie.
Not? Why not?
Like this one.
Exactly. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Perfect. All right.
Awesome.
Excellent. So now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where I will give you
Uh-oh.
some
Okay.
clues, and you have to try and guess what World War II movie we're talking about.
All
You see, the
right.
good thing is because you're at the end of the season, so the number of choices have been dwindled down a little bit.
Oh no. Yes, here's a movie from the
No,
Netherlands
no,
that was made
no,
in
no, no, no,
1965, and I'm
no.
sure you'll recognize. Okay.
Okay, I'm curious if you actually Okay, this is a movie from 1953, starring Jack Hawkins. I saw it for the first time about 6 months ago, and it's about a British convoy escort ship and its officers that are during World War II.
The Seawolf? No.
No, Seawolf was 1941. So this is
Okay.
53, and besides having Jack Hawkins, it also has Denholm Elliott, Stanley Baker. Those are the only names that jump out as names that we might know. I really enjoyed this movie when I saw it for the first time because it was nominated for best special effects, I believe. Maybe it was something else. I remember it was nominated for the no, sorry, it was nominated for the best screenplay at the Oscars that year.
Wow, I may not have seen it. I can't think of it. I'm not sure.
Nope.
I'm just trying to. I think of Action in the North Atlantic, and I don't. I'm also, I'm thinking of movies from the 40s, but 50s. Yeah, no, I'm sorry.
Okay, it's called The Cruel Sea.
Cruel Sea. Okay, I will have to. I'll have to look that one up. I haven't seen that one. Sounds good. Which is, I don't mind not knowing a World War II movie because that means I can go watch it.
That's right. That's
So.
always a good reason. I totally agree with you on that. Definitely works well. Yes. All right. So, Jim, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Well, right now we are doing a good minute-by-minute discussion of of Captain America, the First Avenger, which is a wonderful. I don't think I have to explain what Captain America: The First Avenger is, but it's a wonderful Joe Johnston film, part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and we're taking it apart minute at a time. We've got a bunch of people, including just I know that Hitler's dead in your show, but we just had Hitler on our
That's
show,
right.
at least the guy that
We did.
was in the USO, and great fellow that Hitler guy. At least the actor was, and we've had some interesting side characters and stuff. We're going up many different paths that are kind of tangentially involved with the movie, but we've got some interesting ones coming up shortly, including people that are rebuilding a steam locomotive that hasn't been built. They're building it completely new, and there hasn't been a new steam locomotive built in the U.S. since 1949. So interesting discussion there coming up, but it's all out there at capminute.com, the Captain America Minute podcast. You can also find it wherever you found Rob's podcast. We're probably right next
And
to him.
I as you just said that right now, I was thinking of the outro of your show, and I was waiting for Hal to throw in his line. I can keep this up all day. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieaboutminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieaboutminute@movierob.net. So Jim and I will be back again tomorrow. But until then, Kurahi!
Kurahi!